Hello, and welcome to Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real-World Perspectives. Diabetes Dialogue is a monthly podcast hosted by myself, Dr. Natalie Bellini, and Dr. Diana Isaacs, providing a regular news roundup of the latest clinically applicable insights across diabetes and metabolic diseases, with a focus on leveraging technology to improve diabetes care. Produced by HCP Live Endocrinology, the audio version of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives is available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, with a video version available only on hcplive.com.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives. I'm Diana Isaacs, and joined by my co-host, Natalie Bellini, and we are at the ATTD meeting in Berlin, Germany, and we are so excited that we have Dr. Earl Hirsch joining us. And thank you so much for being here with us. And if you wouldn't mind just introducing yourself to our listeners and viewers.
Sure. My name is Earl Hirsch. I am a professor of medicine at the University of Washington in Seattle, a long way from Berlin.
Yes. Yeah, that was the
last flight. Yes, that's a big trip, huh? Yep.
So I know you've had a number of talks here and you still have some coming up. Can you give us some highlights of what your presentations have been about?
Sure. Thank you for asking. We've been very interested in Seattle about the topic of real estate. And it's a joke, real estate is expensive in Seattle, but that's not the real estate we're talking about. We're talking about real estate from insulin pump users. And the fact that we've seen that over and over again, people run out of real estate. And it's become a real problem when we look at pump occlusions for people who have been on their pumps 15 to 20 years. So we were fortunate with our multidisciplinary team of dermatopathologists, dermatologists, people who do OCT, the same OCT done by the ophthalmologist, except higher resolution, and some of our metabolomic experts, to do a study looking at non-invasive and invasive skin biopsies in 30 patients. Each patient had 3 biopsies, so that's 90 pieces of tissue, in addition to the non-invasive OCT. And each patient had 3 biopsies. One, when they went to the dermatology clinic, they took out their infusion set, and they had a biopsy right there and then of that site. 5 millimeters under the skin. We had the site from 3 days previous, and we had control skin that had never seen insulin before. And that control skin was usually under the axilla. And the bottom line from both the non-invasive and invasive skin biopsies is we saw fibrosis, we saw inflammation, we saw fibrinogen, we saw IGF-1, we saw TGF-beta, we saw fat necrosis, and each of these is worthy of an entire discussion. But what was interesting was we didn't see any difference between the 3-day previous and the current site. What was also interesting, and the reason why we did this, is we had 15 patients with over 20 years on their pump, 15 patients with less than 10 years on their pump, and we didn't see any differences. And so we couldn't really explain why people who had been on their pump longer had more occlusions and more real estate problems. But the most interesting thing we saw, which was not seen in any of the animal models, but explains a lot, is we saw deep infiltration by eosinophils. And the eosinophils, and I had to go back to my medical school stuff to learn about eosinophils. We know they occur with allergy, hypersensitivity. You see it in asthma patients, but you're not supposed to see it under the skin.
Right.
And we don't know why they're there. Is it the preservative? Is it something from the reservoirs or the occlusion, the catheters themselves? Is there something with some of the glue that is used by the pump manufacturers? There's all these chemicals that are put in. Right. Is it something else with the insulin? And when we looked at the symptoms of these patients, 93% of patients had deep skin itching. And we also know from our metabolomics data, which I did not present in detail today, there was a lot of histamines shown, which is consistent. And what I did not know about the eosinophils is that they're also partially responsible for increasing fibrosis under the skin. So the main thing we wanted to do was to try to figure out why people on long-term pump use had more eosinophils or had more pump occlusion problems. And we didn't figure that out. There was a lot of little subplots on data if people want to look at the recording. But I think the bottom line is we saw these eosinophils. We don't understand them. We can look at inflammation and blood flow non-invasively. And by the way, we saw the increase in blood flow both with the non-invasive OCT and with the biopsies. And this increase in blood flow explains, in my view, why the kinetics of insulin change over time. With an automated insulin delivery system, you're probably not going to see any difference. But now that we have week-long infusion sets, I think patients on open loop systems will see that difference in kinetics. And because a week is a long time, we were just looking at 3-day sensors.
Right.
And so there, like any initial study, we were looking for answers and we actually ended up with more questions.
Wow. That's incredible. So what can you just, knowing what you know and looking at some patients, you know, that get more lipohypertrophy than others, can you tie any of that together? I mean, you know, you and I have seen lumps and bumps versus almost none at all. And you can't look at a patient and say you've had diabetes 52 years versus 26 years based on their lipohypertrophy.
Right. We did not study lipohypertrophy. Right. In fact, one or two people at the most had lipohypertrophy.
Okay.
I mean, the point is, I look at the skin of every pump patient who comes in.
Right.
If you see lipohypertrophy, great. But that's not what we were studying.
No, not at all.
And what we studied, you can't see on a physical exam.
Right.
Now, I mentioned the fat necrosis.
Right.
When I heard fat necrosis, I was very excited because the fat necrosis is what was seen in the old lipoatrophy.
Yes.
That we used to see in the animal insulin days.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, very rarely seen anymore. And what I've learned from my dermatology and dermatopathology colleagues is this is more likely than not so much related to the insulin per se, like the lipoatrophy, which is thought to be an immune-mediated reaction, but rather the fat necrosis we saw is more likely than not part of normal wound healing from the catheter.
Okay. Wow.
This is not what we usually talk about in diabetes. We talk about time and ranges.
Right. Yeah. We talk about time and titer ranges. We talk about A1C. We talk about fasting blood sugar.
No, that's not
we
what I'm interested in. I'm doing things that
nobody else does.
Nobody else does.
And this is so important
because as even in our clinic where we had such a high penetration of insulin pump use, that penetration is going up because of AID systems.
Yes, absolutely.
But yet the Achilles heel of this entire technology is the infusion site where very little research has gone over the years.
Right. So do you think, it's you pull it out and it's there 3 days later, it's still there. What's the next study? Are you going to look at, can we look at a month later? Can we look at how long does it take for that to go away basically? And is it going to vary from patient to patient much?
Well, I think those are good questions, but there's a more important question. What is the meaning of this in terms of site failures, set failures?
Right.
Because I've had some people say, and it's a fair question, so what? We're creating all of this pathology under the skin, so what? My original question of why do we see so many set failures, I still can't answer that.
Right.
And so what if there's eosinophils? So what if there's inflammation? One thing I didn't tell you, though, that is interesting. Everybody was wearing a Dexcom G6.
Okay.
And I thought, well, let's look at the inflammation as it compares to time and range and A1C. And there was a direct relationship. The greater the inflammation, the lower the time and range. And also, the greater the inflammation, the greater the insulin dose.
That's really interesting.
So that becomes, now we're getting from this is interesting to maybe there's some clinical issues here.
Right, because it seems like, at least from my experience, a lot of people who've been on pumps, especially for a longer time, have like erratic insulin absorption, like you can't explain highs and then lows. And right. So that would be interesting if that is related.
I mean, it was 30 patients. It's a pilot trial, but it was 90 tissue slices. And even though it's only 30 patients, this is a huge number of skin biopsies. For a skin biopsy study, you don't find many with 90 samples.
No, you don't. Wow. Wow.
And I will tell you, there were many people when I proposed the study, they told me there's no way you're going to find 30 people to do this. There's no way. And we did.
And how long did it take you to recruit?
Can't answer that because everything got shut down during COVID.
Oh, okay.
And so it took much longer
than you ever thought it would. Right. Yep. Yep. Okay. I think people want to know too, right? I mean, I think that people want to know answers too.
It's really interesting. You're absolutely right. When I would ask patients, they would think about this. Yeah, this is something I want to help with if I can help science. And they were good with that.
Right. I think if we ask questions the right way when we're recruiting, even for, you know, skin biopsies aren't fun. No one says, gee, it's Friday night. Let's go get a skin biopsy, right? And yet patients were willing to do it three separate times for you to do this. And it's because they do want to help. In the end, they really do.
Totally agree with that.
Wow.
Well, I know you gave another talk here, or you're giving another talk
here.
I'll
be giving another one.
Yeah, can you tell us a little bit about that one?
So I was planning a study at the beginning of COVID with an intensive care physician by the name of Jamie Crinsley. And Dr. Crinsley is in Stamford, Connecticut, which I didn't know at the time is right outside of New York City. Mm. And we were planning to do a study looking at tight glucose control for COVID admitted patients. And as it turns out, our study didn't get funded. And the reason it didn't get funded is because we wanted to look using CGM at if tight control in the hospital made a difference. And we were told that the study couldn't be funded until we had some CGM data in the hospital. And by the way, we're working on that now in another study. But what happened was I met Dr. Crinsley and we became good friends. And while we were planning the study that didn't get funded, he had a study get published. And we've just been continuing that work. What Dr. Crinsley has done in his ICU in Stamford, Connecticut, starting in 2011, he measured the hemoglobin A1C level of every patient coming into the A1C, coming into the ICU, mm-hmm. whether or not they had diabetes. And of course, in an ICU, they're intubated, they're on pressors, they're getting steroids. Many of these patients, in fact, most of the patients had stress hyperglycemia and needed insulin. Many of these patients had diabetes and didn't know it. Many of them had diabetes and did know it. And what we have been doing is we've been splicing and dicing the data, looking at mortality outcomes. That's really been our only outcome, death.
Okay.
And looking at how it is related to hemoglobin A1C and blood glucose levels in the ICU.
Wow.
Now, one of the things that we learned very early is that if you don't have diabetes or your diabetes is under good control, say an A1C under 6.5, you want to keep those blood glucose levels under very good control. Because if you have an average glucose above 180, your mortality rate is 3 to 4-fold higher if the A1C is low or you don't have diabetes. Now, what if you have diabetes and your A1C is over 8? Well, this is where it gets interesting. If your A1C is over 8 and you bring the blood sugars down to the recommended levels or into the normal range, what happens is you increase mortality risk 5-fold. And the mortality stays 5-fold less, keeping those blood sugars above 180 to 200. Average in the ICU. Your mouth is going open.
Yeah, because
that's really, not what we're doing.
Right? We're doing it wrong.
We're doing now, it wrong.
Well, this is retrospective,
right?
But we have 56, almost 5,700 patients we're looking at.
Wow.
Wow. Let me put another wrinkle to this. What about the population that's well controlled, A1C under 6.5, and they're on insulin? Now, some of these are type 1s because we do not know how many of these actually have a diagnosis of type 1 versus type 2. And even if it's noted in the database, knowing what I know about databases, it's never right anyway.
Right.
No idea.
Right.
But if the A1C is under 6.5 and you are on insulin and you bring the blood sugars down into the normal range on average, you actually have an increased risk of death. And in that population, what we showed was that you have a reduced mortality, keeping the blood sugars above 180.
Wow.
And so then the question is, okay, well, maybe those people who died because they're just sicker and because they have greater stress. So what we did, and we have an entire paper on this, and I'm going to show this in two slides, but we try to control for that using Apache 4 scores. And the Apache system is a way to, in an unbiased way, look at how sick somebody is, their level of illness. And in the critical care literature, there's something called the observed to expected mortality.
Right.
And the O to E ratio. And that should normalize for how sick they are. And the bottom line is, the higher the O to E ratio, the higher the mortality.
Right.
And so, and that is in the buckets of A1C. And so I think we've pretty much answered the question. And so the bottom line for me from all this data, and we have about a half a dozen papers not published from this, but the bottom line to me from all of this is that it's too soon to change our guidelines,
right?
But we need an RCT in the ICU to see what these glucose targets really should be.
Yeah, and it sounds like it needs to be individualized.
The term precision medicine is maybe overused now.
Mm-hmm.
And another part of my research that I am not talking about here, we actually have an abstract we're going to be showing at, hopefully showing at ADA, about some of the problems with A1C. And, you know, this study is looking at A1C in a very large size population, but A1Cs in an individual are really very difficult to interpret. In a population, it's very good. If you have somebody who has a discordance with their A1C, either high or low, I'd rather look at time and range or GMI.
Absolutely.
Than A1C, right. based on, for an individual. I don't think we're even close to that yet. But with all that being said, I think this part of my presentation here is going to get a lot of people thinking about maybe this is the reason why. Maybe this is the reason why the 5 randomized controlled trials in the ICU have had mixed results. And maybe this is the reason why, when you look at the meta-analyses showing the fact that people with diabetes at any given glucose have lower mortalities than people without diabetes, because in those studies, nobody knew what the A1C was, and nobody knew if they were on insulin or not.
And the hard part is, you can't go back now and get an A1C from someone that was in ICU, right? You could go back and say if they were on insulin before they walked in the door, but that other piece that's such an integral part of what you've learned,
right?
We can't go back and do that, right?
We call that the hyperglycemia paradox. And I know, especially if you go back a decade, 2 decades, very little attention was put onto glucose control in the ICU, especially after the NICE sugar study came out
right.
In 2009. That sort of said, don't worry about it because there's too much hypoglycemia in the ICU. But the reality is, nobody paid attention to, they paid a little bit of attention if they had diabetes or not, but nobody paid attention to the A1C. They weren't measured.
Oh.
And so this hyperglycemia paradox showing improved survival in people with diabetes with hyperglycemia, I think it's because the glucose levels were not treated aggressively, and these were people who had high A1Cs.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah,
what an incredible, I just love that you think about, right? You walk around and think, I got to figure out what's going on under the skin. I have to think about what's in my yeah. patients in the ICU. Your gift to the diabetes community of those of us that treat diabetes is not you come to a meeting like this and we're all talking about time and range. You're like, I don't want to talk about time and range. Everyone else is doing that. I want to talk about this. What's the next thing? And that's, we so appreciate
yeah,
that.
We
like
so
your
appreciate
insight
it.
Into
you know, I've just been lucky in the right place at the right time. I'm surrounded by these amazing dermatopathologists and dermatologists. Andrea Calouse, who is the dermatologist I work with, she's also a board certified internist.
Wow.
So I'm just so fortunate to be surrounded by these people who are much smarter than me. And then for the ICU stuff, I met Jamie Crinsley and I brought into our little group two very out of the box thinkers about all of this, Michael Brownlee and Mike Schwartz, and trying to come up with mechanisms. Why is this happening?
Right.
And that's the other whole topic.
That's the next step, right?
Well, we have hypotheses. I think the answer, I think Mike Schwartz, and we actually had a paper in this month's Diabetes Care, topic called relative hypoglycemia. It's the brain, and the brain that looks at these counter-regulatory hormones when somebody has a high A1C, it turns on the entire sympathoadrenal system, and it's just
well,
not
they
good.
Feel low. They have symptomatic hypoglycemia at 120, 150,
right.
as we do this in outpatient. So inpatient, is it different?
But it's every part of diabetes, and it's obesity. The GLP-1s, they turn that switch off for satiety. You give a type 2 diabetic mouse FGF1, you cure the diabetes. You give a NOD mouse leptin directly into the brain, who's making no insulin, you cure the diabetes. See, here's the problem. We've been focused on the islets, the liver, and the muscle. And it's time for us to look
it's
at the
so
brain.
Much more, right?
The brain. The brain is, I think, controlling all of this. And I think my prediction is 20, 30 years from now, long after, at least I'll be long, long retired, or even further along than that, I think diabetes will be looking at the brain as opposed to these other organs.
Wow.
Wow. Well, you've given
wow.
us yeah, so,
so
much.
Much to think about.
Yeah,
right.
That is, oh my God, I could listen to you all day. I want to thank you so much
You're
for joining
welcome.
Us and sharing all your wisdom with us.
You're very welcome.
We appreciate it.
Thank you.